It's an enormous pleasure to be able to introduce Karen Armstrong to you. Karen is very well known for her 20 or so books that she has written. You'll see from the program that she won the TED Prize in 2008, and the Charter for Compassion has been taking up an enormous amount of her time, and we're extremely lucky that she's actually in England right now over this weekend, so that we were able to persuade her to come down and share her insights with you. She's going back to New York shortly and will be speaking in Washington at the National Cathedral on September the 11th next month. And so this is the kind of profile that Karen has globally. And so it's an enormous privilege that she's taken time out of her schedule to come and share her insights with us. Now, she's going to talk a little bit about this, but I just want to highlight the website for the Charter for Compassion, www.charterforcompassion.org. And Karen tells me it's going to become a lot more interactive than it currently is. And so do sign up on the website for news updates and participation. And for those of you on Facebook, there is a Facebook page as well, and so you can sign up on that. So this will become a lot more visible, and Karen is one of the is a figurehead really for this work. And so, as Peter Fenwick might say, I cannot think of anyone better to share her insights on compassion. 12 Steps to Compassionate Life, her book, which you'll see out there, and she's speaking about the Charter for Compassion, Wishing for a Better World. Karen Armstrong.
Thank you very much. Well, you've just heard I won the TED Prize in 2008, and at the time I'd never heard of TED. I'd been told I'd got the TED Prize, and who on earth is TED? Fred or Sid? But no. The TED conferences and the TED talks on ideas worth spreading, every year they give awards to people whom they think have made a difference, but who, with their help, could make more of an impact. Jamie Oliver got it a couple of years ago, Bill Clinton and E.O. Wilson. So I was the first person they gave it to with any religious background. So it was it's a very secular organization. They give you some money, but more importantly, they give you a wish for a better world, which TED will try to make happen. And I knew almost immediately what I wanted, because it's long been a source of absolute frustration to me that the religions, which should be making a major contribution to one of the chief tasks of our time, which is to build a global community where people of all ethnicities and ideologies can live together in mutual respect, are often, for obvious reasons, seen as part of the problem. Every single one of them has developed its own version of what's often called the golden rule. Never treat others as you would not like to be treated yourself, or in its positive form, always treat all others as you would wish to be treated. And they've said that, not the acceptance of a certain doctrine or the adoption of a particular sexual ethos, is the test of faith, that it is that which brings us into relation with the transcendent. And yet, very often, when you'd never know it, we hear a lot when religious people make pronouncements of fulminations against this or that, or they meet together and condemn homosexuality, or else come out with a doctrinal statement saying that is the criterion of true faith. And I've lost count of the number of times I've jumped into a taxi in London and been reliably informed by the cabbie, when he asks me what I do for a living, that religion has been the cause of all the major wars in history. I have given up and sort of say I'm a typist these days. But actually, the cause of war is greed, ambition, envy, rage, hatred. And it's true that these unworthy emotions are often given a religious or ideological justification. But religion is about compassion. And so I asked Ted, when I accepted the prize, to help me to create, launch and propagate a charter for compassion, which would be composed by hundreds and thousands of people online. Ted created a multilingual website in Urdu, Arabic, Hebrew, Spanish, and English. And I put a draft charter online, and week by week, people responded to that draft. These findings were collected and brought together to a council of 20 or so activists. I didn't want scholars necessarily. Some of them were scholars, but I was afraid of that sort of nitpicking kind of thing that can creep into academia. But these people are thinkers, activists, and leaders representing six major world faiths: Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Confucianism. And the Grand Mufti of Egypt came, for example. Three rabbis were there, and it was a wonderful conversation. We created this short charter, you can see it on the website, and we launched it in 2009. But it was essentially a call to action. This is urgent, because, as I said last night, if we want a peaceful world, we have to introduce the golden rule into the complex realities of the 21st century. We have to treat all peoples, whoever they are, whatever they think, as we would wish to be treated ourselves. And if we don't do this, we are not going to have a viable world. And if we had done this more in the past, in our former colonies, for example, we would not be having some of the problems that we have today, with short-sighted, greedy policies which have supported nefarious rulers over the world. And we are now in this awful mess. So there is urgency in this. And I know you're going to be hearing a lot about theory, but compassion demands, as much as you learn about, and it's very important to know how these things work with the structure of our brains, because I think the fact that all the religions have independently come up with this ideology shows that it resonates deeply with the way human beings work. Furthermore, they all realize that this is the only way we can live together. The problem is that we are bound more closely together than ever before. Economically, when one market goes down, there's a domino effect as stocks plummet all around the globe. We are profoundly interconnected with the World Wide Web. We all face environmental catastrophe. And today, what happens in Afghanistan or Gaza is now likely to have repercussions in New York, Washington, and London. It's no longer true to say that suffering is confined to a distant part of the globe. We are all interconnected. We rise and stand and fall with one another. And our perceptions have not yet caught up with the reality of the global market that we've created. We have to learn to live with one another. But what is compassion? It's, I think, the word has got so weakened that people think it means pity. I was giving a lecture in the Netherlands a couple of years ago, and I specifically said that compassion does not mean feeling sorry for people. But in the Dutch translation of my speech in the newspaper, every time I said compassion, it was translated pity. This kind of thing is ingrained. And you heard yesterday, compassion, it comes from compathein. That's often translated to feel with the other, to endure with the other. But I'd like to take the emphasis out of feeling, for example, just for this morning. Feelings are important, but they come and go. You can sometimes feel full of rage at your nearest and dearest. if you've had a bad night or you've got a headache. Feelings come and go. What is required is a principled determination to act and speak and think in a more empathic manner, putting yourself in other people's shoes. Kompathein, to endure with another, to enter into their pain, to realize that every human being has pain. We are all linked together. I don't need to tell you as psychiatrists, we are all linked together by the experience of pain, which with Buddhists call dukkha, the first noble truth. Existence is dukkha. There's pain, something awry, something wrong with our existence. That is the beginning of our quest. But other traditions have brought out something other. Rahma in both Hebrew and Arabic is related etymologically to the word for womb. And compassion is related to the word for womb. That brings up the whole ethos of mother love. And the icon of the mother and child is a universal symbol of everything that is good in our humanity. But mother love is hard. A mother has to get up every night to her dying child, whether she feels like it or not. She has to put her own exhaustion, her own needs on the back burner and be aware of what that child is doing at every single moment of the day. And then that child, that dear little cute baby, grows up and can become a horrible disappointment. But the mother still doesn't give up. The mother still is concerned for that child. Whatever she's feeling like, she has that concern and that responsibility and that link. And there's an early Buddhist prayer attributed, I think, to the Buddha himself, which said, let us cherish all creatures as a mother her only child. We are all called to feel for every single creature, every single human being, no matter how disappointing or disillusioning they may be, every single species, as that we have to have that sense of responsibility for every single one of them. That is what we are called to do. In Buddhism, the karuna, compassion, it's often translated, it doesn't just mean feeling sorry for people or a vague feeling of pity. It's a commitment to end the suffering of every single creature. A responsibility, that responsibility that a mother has, to look at the pain in the world and say, that is not their problem. That is my problem. We are, because it will ultimately all rebound on us, as the Dalai Lama says. What goes around comes around. We are all so interconnected. And we are not behaving like this at the moment. Just pick up the newspapers. And I think part of the problem is, in religious terms, is that in the West, in the late 17th century, we changed the meaning of the word belief. A belief, and I've written a whole book about this, and I can't go zooming into this now, but perhaps you can ask me later, it's a Q&A session later. The original beleven in Chaucer's day meant loyalty, fealty, commitment. It translates the Greek word pistis in the New Testament, which means, again, commitment, dedication. Jesus is asking for faith, and he's not asking them to believe that he's the second person of the Blessed Trinity, an idea he'd have found rather odd, I think, or surprising. He's asking for people who are willing to work night and day for the coming of the kingdom, to give what they have to the poor, to live like the birds of the air and the lilies of the field, and have pistis in God the Father. And create here on earth the kingdom of God, which is not some nebulous realm with people strumming harps on clouds. It's a realm here on earth where rich and poor can sit down together at the same table and are treated with respect. And that pistis faith is what Religion is about doing things. Religion is not a mental head trick where you tick off a number of boxes to say you believe in this, that, or the other. It is a commitment. It's a form of practical knowledge, like driving a car or swimming. You can't learn to dance simply by reading a book or learning the theory. You have to practice every day. And if you practice with discipline every day, you can make your body do things that are absolutely impossible for an untrained body. But if you're just sitting reading a book about dancing, you're not going to get very far. And people have found that if they practice the golden rule, as Confucius said, all day and every day, they acquire new capacities of mind and heart. And the myths of religion, a myth in the ancient world was not some fairy story, it was primarily a program for action. You didn't understand the truth of a myth unless you put it into practice. Like, just as when you start swimming, you think, how can this work? I'll sink. But then you acquire the knack, and you learn to do it. You have to get into the pool and trust yourself to the element. And that is what faith is. Now, what they're saying, these masters of the spiritual life, the great geniuses, the prophets of Israel, the Buddha, the sages of the Upanishads, they are all saying that the compassion is the key. The Greeks called a certain state of mind ecstasis, which doesn't mean, again, some exotic trance. It means standing outside, ecstasis, the self. And people found that if every day they put themselves in the person of another, they were transcending the selfishness and egotism that holds us back from our best selves. The first person, as far as we know, to formulate the golden rule was Confucius, 500 years before the Common Era. And his disciples asked him, "Master, which of your teachings can we put into practice all day and every day? And what is the central thread that runs through all your teaching?" And Confucius said, "Shu," which can be translated likening to the self, which means look into your own heart, discover what it is that gives you pain, and then refuse under any circumstance whatsoever to inflict that pain on anybody else. Never treat others, said Confucius, as you would not like to be treated yourself. It demands that you look into yourself and apply that knowledge to the way you treat others. And notice, all day and every day, we have a habit here of, when we've done something nice for somebody, of saying, "Well, that's my good deed for the day," as though we could then return for the next 23 hours to our usual lives of bitterness and greed and selfishness, all day and every day. And there's a wonderful, you can find it if you buy my book, but it's also in my book, The Great Transformation and The Case for God, where Confucius's most gifted pupil described the effects of living all day and every day in compassion, putting yourself in the place of another. He said it draws you continually on. And the important thing in China is that the ultimate reality is often called the Tao, the way. The Chinese were less concerned, as we are, to define what lay at the end of the religious quest, God and heaven and all that. But the experience of living all day, every day, as emptying yourself in ego to reach out to the other, that will bring you the transcendence you seek. It's the process itself which is important. And Confucius's disciples, Confucius was very, very politically minded. And one of the things to notice is that all these great sages were living in times like our own, where violence and coercion and state power had reached an unprecedented level. They were not living on in desert fastnesses or solitary mountaintops. They were living in societies that had been taught, were being torn apart, and realized that this was essential for survival. China was about to enter a hideous period called the war, the period of the warring states, in which after two or three centuries, all the big states fought each other until there was only one left, with horrific loss of life. This is what, this is the situation. How do you apply this politically? Confucius said, it's easy. You seek to establish yourself, then seek to establish others. You seek to turn your merits to account, then make it clear that, make sure that others also have the ability to turn their merits to account. Don't just treat people for oil, what to get short-term advantages like oil or strategic advantage or to gain a sort of political advantage. You seek to establish yourself, then seek to establish others. And that is our mission in this perilous moment of history. Somebody who came after Confucius was Mozi. And he was a bit unfair to Confucius. He thought Confucius confined himself too much to the family, which isn't true. Confucius sat in the middle of a series of concentric circles with you going out broader and broader out from the family to society. But he saw the family as the school of compassion, where you learn to be compassionate. But Mozi said, we have to have concern for everybody, Yan Ai, even our enemies, said Jesus. For everybody, not just the people we find congenial. That is simply group egotism. So Yan Ai, and that love the stranger, said Leviticus. Reach out to all tribes and nations, says the Quran. We have to go beyond our own immediate congenial circle. My favorite golden rule story, perhaps, though, is Hillel, the great Pharisee, older contemporary of Jesus, who was approached, it said, by a pagan who promised to convert to Judaism on if Hillel could recite the whole of Jewish teaching, the Torah, while he stood on one leg. And Hillel said, that which is hateful to you, do not to your fellow human being. That is Torah. And everything else is only commentary. Go and study it. And an audacious, deliberately provocative statement. He's not saying that these other things aren't important. They are. But what he's saying is that, that this is the core. Never mind the existence of God or the creation of the world in 6 days or the election of Israel or the exodus from Egypt. All that, he said, is simply a commentary, a gloss on the Golden Rule. Now, I wrote a book called 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, and you'll notice the reference to Alcoholics Anonymous, because we are addicted to our pet hates. We don't know how we'd manage without our special little dislikes. I see people's faces fall. What, never again make an unpleasant remark about my boss? But we get, rather as we do with the first drink of the day, a sort of wonderful sort of buzz when we say something vile but clever about another person. I know because I have a very, very sharp tongue. So it was a process of weaning ourselves away slowly from that addiction by practices. Because people were asking me about, when I was implementing the charter, what on earth, how do we do this? It's so huge. Two things, just went to briefly, for example, step 7 and 8. First, how little we know. We are, this is the age of information, and we all are encouraged, quite rightly, to have our own opinions. But when you listen to some of these phone-ins, etc., you really wince if you happen to know about the subject under discussion. And our media isn't always very helpful in providing us with full information. And the way we speak about one another. Oh, the trouble with him is. Or, well, you know, she is always. As though you could sum up the extraordinary, exquisite mystery of a single human being in a single sentence. usually to service our own needs, our own egos. We docket people in this way. And we do it with whole cultures, whole religious traditions. I mean, I'm involved in very much in sort of outreach to the Muslim world. And what people and pundits say about Islam is hair-raising. Often the amount of information, the trouble with Islam is, and the amount of reliable information they have could be comfortably contained on the back of a small postcard. Often the way we talk about other peoples and other nations and other cultural traditions is based on a half-remembered op-ed piece here or a television interview we've seen there that happens to chime with something we've heard before. Whereas each one of us is a profound mystery, and when you think of each religious tradition, for example, consists of multifarious strands. Think, how could you sum up Christianity, for example? And yet, that's the way we behave. And how do we speak with one another? Often in the West, our discourse, even in sort of academic circles, is aggressive. It's not enough for us to seek the truth in politics, in the media, in academia. We also have to denigrate, wound, discredit our opponents and make them feel small and stupid. That's very different from the kind of dialogue. We keep on talking about dialogue as though if we all engaged in dialogue, peace would break out. But what people often mean by dialogue is trying to bludgeon the other side into accepting their own position. And we don't listen to one another. You often see on a television debate that while somebody is holding forth, the others aren't really listening. They're really thinking of the next brilliant remark that they're going to make, or how they could twist that person's words in order to give a sharp thrust. There's no point in going into dialogue with other people or other peoples unless we are prepared to be changed by the encounter at some profound level, and to listen. Listen not only to the rhetoric of somebody's story, but to listen to the pain and rage and inchoate distress that often lies behind a narrative. You don't need me, that many of you are psychiatrists, I believe, when you listen to people's pain, what actually happened is one thing. But what the person feels and what has produced this narrative is a major part of the story. And that applies on the political front too. How's the Charter doing? Well, it's taken off in ways that we couldn't have imagined. Interestingly, the people who have been most active and who have come forward have been businessmen and women. And now that is something I could never have predicted. I have the business head of a chicken. I'm the despair of my accountants. But these men understand that we need peace. Some of them are profoundly religious, but they're doing this not in a religious way because they're working with, all kinds of people, some with extremely secular problems. One of the things they're all doing now internationally in the Middle East, Pakistan, and in the United States is working together to apply the 12 steps to business ethics. All kinds of things. One businessman in Seattle, for example, who's now retired from Microsoft, and his own story is extraordinary, but I don't have time to tell it to you. He devised a program for the training of prison officers. This was introduced into a very difficult jail in Washington State. And it was a training program. It wasn't just going in there and being nice to the prisoners. It was a whole discipline of how to speak, how to stand, how to pitch your voice, etc. And the aim was to decrease violence in the jail by 2.5%. And when the governor rang Ari to say, with the results, he said, "Are you sitting down?" And it was 100% improvement. Nobody was in the slammer. And now these practical businessmen are working out exactly what it would save the federal government and the state governments in prison security. That this is practical, it makes practical sense, and they feel it makes practical sense also for business. But it doesn't stop there. In 1210, Seattle declared itself the first city of compassion, and the mayor proclaimed the charter. Now, this doesn't mean to say that we are now a compassionate city, but that we are now striving to implement the golden rule in the city, which is the heart, the gritty, difficult heart of modernity. And each they collected 1,000 signatures, and each year they have as it were a shadow city council, dealing with things like housing or health, homeless, and so they sort of keep a watch on the way things are going in the city and working in conjunction with the city council. There was a terrible shooting incident last year which tore the city apart, and these people were able to bring the different parties together and finally bring about reconciliation in the city. But each year they work on a particular project. Last year it was an environmental project. This coming year it's going to be business. Seattle has all these big companies. But the point is, not that you'll manage to clean up the water in that area, though that's important too, but that you are beginning to change your mindset. It's action and working together and putting the ideas, the needs of others at the forefront of your mind. You're beginning to change your mindset and thinking not in that self-centered way that we are often encouraged to have, me first, there's no quick fix to this. They have now started a 10-year outreach program to invite other cities to take this on too. Our aim is to create a network of compassionate cities worldwide. And all of you can make your city a city for compassion. There's a process and a kit that shows the steps to go forward. And my dream ultimately is to have a sort of between cities in different parts of the world, say to have a city in the Middle East teamed up, say, with Chicago. And so the students and older people can email one another, form friendships, keep abreast of one another's news, problems, and gradually these prejudices we have about one another get slowly eroded. Universities are also pairing with one another too in that way. So far there are about 50 cities worldwide now waiting to go through this process. I think 3 or 4 have already signed up, but we're stretching ahead. So that is our big push at the moment, to build up this, where to bring compassion to the forefront of people's minds. And I'd like to sort of make a difference in the way people speak, as I say, and think. It can be done. If you think, the feminists and the human rights activists in the 1960s and 70s changed the way we speak and think about gender and race. Believe it or not, when I was growing up in the 1950s, there was actually a fashion shade called Nigger Brown. Something that would be unheard of today. So it can be done, but it won't be done if we just sit back doing nothing. Now, the jewel in the crown, as far as I am concerned, however, is Pakistan. Pakistan is on the edge of, on the front line. This is a place where all the problems that are tearing us apart are concentrated, and the whole thing could implode. Pakistan is now leading the charter. Again, a young businessman who's worked with me before and had me over to speak in Pakistan several times. He's got together in each of the three major cities a team of about 50 or 60 people, CEOs, educationalists, lawyers, media people, bloggers, and they are working. And he is a nagger. He does not let you go. The Seattle people are working with him, and they can't keep up with his. He will say to me, Karen, I'm very sorry to say I've spoke to them 2 days ago and I've still not heard back. And, you know, but he is relentless. I went for a week in February, and was speaking three times a day, and 1,000 people at least were coming each time, and sitting around the floor sometimes, no room. And would we, and I was talking to them about Islam. Now, would, and Amin would say to me, don't you be polite to us. You challenge us. You tell us where we're going wrong. Now, would we invite a Pakistani over here and come and listen to him, 1,000 people each time, three times a day, who is talking to us about Christianity or democracy, and listening to him criticize? We would not. But they lap it up. I feel like a rock star in Pakistan because people are desperate for something different. Again, he is very practically minded. He said it has taken 35 years for the country to reach this state, and we in the West are involved in what has happened in Pakistan. I can't go into that now, perhaps in question time. But we are involved in it. It's not just their mess. We've helped to create this. And it's taken 35 years to reach this impasse. He said, we're not looking for any big improvements in for another 10 years. But education is the key. The team have introduced modules of compassion into various teaching subjects like English literature, English language, history and religion. That kind of idea gets going. The company that makes Sesame Street in Pakistan has introduced a compassionate character. And I said to them, I want this guy to be really cool, not some kind of simp handing out flowers. I want him to be funny and clever and to make mistakes sometimes, because goodness knows we all fail in compassion. And this company, a marvelous company, their theater has been bombed several times by the extremists in Pakistan because they hold Sufi ceremonies there. They are going to take, they have a roadshow which they take their puppets out into the rural, poorer areas, the flood areas too. So the people, the preschool children will recognize this character, and this character can be used by us in the curriculum at the primary level. And it's going to be mandatory in all the independent universities. We can't touch the public sector because that's in the hand of the Wahhabi government, compulsory teaching, which we help to implement in the West. But the independent sector will be mandatory at university level to take a course in compassion. And during Ramadan, they are now working with Jordan across the Gulf. And during Ramadan, Jordan is working now in concert with them in exactly the same way with teams. And during Ramadan, they are having on a big internet web. One compassionate act a day during Ramadan. They post them up, and there'll be prizes for the most imaginative and groundbreaking thing. Now, Amin says this year perhaps we'll only get 10,000. Next year we want to go into, we will, he said, get into Saudi Arabia. These things go round on the internet. And the idea again is to bring compassion to the fore. To change the mindset of the people so that it is something that it is a resource that people think about instead of just dismissing it to some kind of hippie nonsense or sentimental feeling. Well, love your enemies. Now, Jesus, when he said love your enemies, the word love did not mean emotion. In chesed, in Hebrew, it means loyalty. It was a term used in international treaties in the ancient Middle East. Two kings would promise to love each other, which didn't mean they fell into one another's arms and became best friends. They may have been former enemies, but now they would promise to look out for each other's interests, to give each other practical support and help. even if this went against their short-term interest, to come to their aid in time of trouble. This is the kind of love that we have to give our enemies if we want a viable world to hand on to the next generation. Now, I'd like to finish with the Greeks, because we don't often think of the Greeks as a compassionate people. They were a warlike people, like us. They started the whole Western warfare, a method of warfare of head-on confrontation instead of sensibly hiding behind shields, etc., when you're fighting. But in the 5th century, at the height, BCE, at the height of their cultural florescence, they introduced the genre of tragedy. And everybody was obliged to attend the plays that were put on every year in the little theatre on the Acropolis, on the festival of Dionysus, god of transformation. This was a religious ceremony. And everybody was obliged to go. Even prisoners were let out of jail. It was a civic duty. And the plays usually recast one of the ancient Greek myths in such a way that it reflected some of the problems that Athens had been going through that year. And the periodically, the leader of the chorus would point to a man or a woman who is presented in searing agony and say, "Weep, weep for Oedipus, a person who had broken every taboo in the book. Weep for Heracles, a man who'd been driven mad by a goddess and slaughtered his wife and children. Now weep for them." And they put suffering on stage. And instead of pushing it to the back of our minds, "Well, I can't deal with this, I've got another earthquake, another hurricane, can't bear it, let's turn over the channel," to put it on stage. And the Greeks did weep. They weren't like modern Western men. They didn't just gulp and wipe an embarrassed tear from the corner of their eye. They wept aloud because they believed that weeping together created a bond between human beings, because they felt they were not alone in their pain. The first of these plays that has come down to us was Aeschylus's The Persians. It was presented about 5 or 6 years after the Greeks had defeated the Persian army at the naval battle of Salamis. But before they had defeated the Persians, the Persian army had rampaged through Athens, trashed the city, smashed all the beautiful temples on the Acropolis, and robbed and vandalized. And now Aeschylus asks the Athenian audience, "Weep for the Persians. Look at the Battle of Salamis from the Persians' point of view. There's no triumphalism, no gloating. The Greeks and the Persians are said to be sister nations, equal in majesty and nobility." Xerxes, the defeated general, comes home and is escorted with great respect into his palace, and the people are presented as Persians are presented as a people in mourning, for whom we weep and extend our sympathies. And that is deeply enshrined in the Greek tradition. It goes right back to Homer. You'll know this story. But I end with it because this is what compassion means and this is what it can do. In the Iliad, as you know, I'm sure, tells the story of one small incident in the 10-year war between the Greeks and the Trojans. In the course of that this incident, Achilles, the chief warrior on the Greek side, has a quarrel with his king, and in a fit of egotistic self-serving pique, he sulks in his tent, and more importantly, he withdraws all his troops from the army. This is disastrous for the Greek side. And in the course of the ensuing confusion, Achilles' beloved friend Patroclus is killed by one of the Trojan princes, Hector. And Achilles goes mad with rage and grief and guilt. He loses his humanity completely, the gods even, who are aghast. And he summons Hector to a duel. And the two of them fight it out in front of both armies. The Hector's family, the royal Trojan royal family, are watching from the city walls. And Achilles kills Hector. And then he mutilates the body. He ties it to the back of his war chariot and drives it round and round and round Patroclus's grave. And then he does a terrible thing. He refuses to hand the body of Hector back to the family for burial. And that means that Hector's spirit will never know rest. It will wander dissatisfied, unhappy, and displaced for all eternity. But one night, old King Priam of Troy, Hector's father, comes in disguise into the Greek camp. And he makes his way to Achilles' tent. And then he takes off his disguise. Of course, everybody is shocked. And the old man comes and falls at Achilles' feet. And he embraces Achilles' knees. And he weeps. He weeps for all the sons of his that Achilles has slain. Not just Hector, but Achilles has killed many of Priam's sons. And Achilles looks at his own father. And the old man, he remembers his own father. And he starts to weep. And the two men weep unashamedly together. Each from their own pain, but creating that bond. As Homer says, Priam weeps for his sons, and Achilles weeps now for his father, now for Patroclus. And then they stop weeping. And they look at each other. And then Achilles takes Hector's body and carries it and lays it very gently in the arms of the old man, very concerned that the weight will be too much for him. And that there's a numinous silence in which each sees the other as divine. And that brings it full circle. We are at our most godlike, at our most divine, when we realize that our enemies also have pain. And that is the only way, and to cultivate that spirit is the only way that we can reach forward to a better, a more peaceful and more safe and just world. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Extremely powerful, practical, urgent. What impulse could be more important? And we're very privileged to be part of this. And I'm sure you'll join me in enthusiastically endorsing what Karen has shared with us this morning. And we, as she's said, I mean, each of us has some. This is something that we can all practice all day and every day, as she said. So. Let's make a start in this conference, and we can then compare our notes as we leave tomorrow. Anyway, I'm sure there are a lot of questions that people would like to, or points that people would like to raise. We have some microphones on both sides. If you give your name, please, as you ask your question, and try to make your questions brief, because I'm sure there will be a lot of them. And Karen, also, if you could make your answers relatively brief as well. Thank you.
My name is Andrea, and if we are at our most divine in this compassionate state, why were we equipped with feelings that come so swiftly, like rage and hatred? And why do we have to fight this in order to be our most divine?
Well, you're going to hear all about that, I'm sure, from Paul tomorrow, about why we've got these impulses of rage and the four Fs, he calls them. Feeding, fleeing, fighting, and reproduction. And these are strong, They're powerful, they're automatic, and we're meant to have them. If a tiger suddenly jumps into the auditorium, we're meant to abandon our high-minded conversation and run for our lives. If we hadn't had these, we wouldn't have survived. They come from, I believe, the reptilian brain. You'll hear all about this tomorrow, I'm sure. But there they are, and they inform everything we do. They inform our love affairs. We get all territorial and jealous and greedy. They inform our religion. But we've also got these other, and I'm sure you'll be hearing all about this too, with these other centers as mammals learnt to care for their young. There are various sort of hormones and brain centers and reflexes that we have that are there that can be cultivated. And that's what we do as human beings. We probably learn to run and jump to get away from our predators, to flee. But we have developed dancing and gymnastics. We've taken these and taken them to a new level. And the religious people have cultivated these natural tendencies we have that are not as strong as the four Fs, but they can be cultivated because we have a duty to protect other people from our own destructiveness.
Thank you. Over here, Clement.
Clement Jewett. This was a very moving account you gave, Karen Armstrong, and I am indeed moved. But a thought occurs to me about the project you outline, that a very important part of it would seem to me to be to educate the mainstream media, who are apparently unaware of yours and many other initiatives being carried on under their radar.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the media has a massive, massive responsibility. Just talking with a couple of you last night about Fox News, for example, in the United States. But our own media I had a meeting in Washington with leaders, media leaders and TV leaders about the way they present religion. And it's always we hear about the extremists. We don't, when the Gallup poll, for example, was taken, the biggest poll Gallup have ever done in 35 Muslim countries, 7 years they took. And the findings should have been blazoned across every newspaper and have been headline news. One of the questions people were asked was, were the 9/11 attacks justified? 93% said no. And the reasons they gave were religious. The 7% who said yes, they don't want to commit that themselves, but yes, they could see what happened. They did not cite religion, they cited politics. What is it that you admire most about the West? I think the largest number, I think it was nearly 60%, said Western freedom. So all this talk about they hate our freedom and all the rest of it is complete rubbish. And what is it that Western people can do to influence better relations? Stop slagging off Islam. Stop sort of, trashing our sacred traditions from a point of view of pure ignorance. I don't know what we can do about the media, because when I was talking to them about this in Washington, they said, look, it's just not news. And if something isn't on the 6 o'clock news, basically it hasn't happened as far as most people know. I mean, the floods in Pakistan got almost no coverage in the United States. And what people should have heard to get a full picture of what the Pakistani people are like is that major business leaders, including some of the people who are now working with me for the charter, put their businesses on hold for 3 months and went off to the flood areas and lived in tents to bring help to these people using their network. That's what we should hear. All we hear about Pakistan are bombing. And not this sort of open, the fact it's actually quite a secular society, you'd never know that from our media. In those 3 weeks I was exhausted, they said it was a most uncompassionate schedule, but I had never been we had such fun, they're so light-hearted and warm, and we should hear about this and about these stories too. And that's one of the things I want the charter website to do. And to do it, I'm almost given up with, I think let's try doing things in the social media. Network and Twitter is what I'm a bit of a dinosaur about these matters. But TED are not, and they've introduced me to this. And so we need to try and make a comeback and try to, all of us, it's not just leave it to the charter people, all of us demand better media. Because we will have no peace if we go on like this, with this ignorant, partial way of reporting, which just confirms prejudice, induces a sense of righteousness, and doesn't ever sort of see where we may also have been implicated too.
Thank you. Beata.
Beata Bishop. Discernment kept coming to mind. Unconditional acceptance, unconditional compassion, yes. But I was sitting in a train in Germany and the young man opened his jacket and on his T-shirt there was a portrait of Adolf Hitler. Mm-hmm. And in German, Adolf Hitler was right. And he opened his jacket for me to see it. And I didn't know what to do. No. So I did nothing.
This is absolutely central. We have, I'm not saying that we just go around saying, oh, fine, you know, we love you anyway. We have to speak out when that kind of thing happens. We have to speak out and make our voices heard when we hear things misreported on the media, for example. When there are issues of justice and cruelty, either at home or abroad, we have to speak out. But I like to take a leaf out of Gandhi's book. This was something that came out a lot in Pakistan. I didn't mention this was Gandhi. I didn't think that might go down too well. But where Gandhi said that when you are about to speak against something or... are you speaking to punish and to injure or to make things better? And somehow we have to find a mode of discourse that isn't aggressive because our discourse is so aggressive. We get into a fight, that does no good. We need to speak firmly, and this is a big issue in Pakistan. The big question was always, how do we speak to the intolerant? And so we have to discover, we have to work on this to find a new method of discourse to say firmly and quietly that we find this offensive. I find St. Paul's Hymn to Charity gives me a good checklist when I'm about to inveigh. Charity is patient, is kind. Charity is not puffed up. A weaker translation has it's never boastful or conceited, but I like puffed up because sometimes when people are inveighing against something, it's absolutely disgraceful. They almost swell before their eyes in delighted self-congratulation. This is ego. And often, it takes no delight in the wrongdoing of others. When we are excoriating other people, we're often, again, swelling with delighted self-congratulation. This is me, and I really disapprove of this, because I am such a great person. We have to realize that in a lot of these things, the Hitler thing, I don't know what I would have done either, but simply to find a way to say calmly and quietly with religious movements, which I've studied more, every single one of these militant movements has grown out of profound fear. I don't know about the neo-Nazis, but profound fear. Everyone, whether it's Jewish, Christian, Muslim, is convinced that liberal secular society wants to wipe them out and began with what was perceived by an assault by the secular or liberal establishment. And that fear has often hardened into rage and because it's been ignored. And history shows that when these movements are attacked, they invariably become more extreme. So somehow we have to find that in that Gandhi-like way of mode of discourse. The Buddha, as far as we can tell from his dialogues, when people came to ask him a question, he didn't just give them a huge lecture. He would go into where they were then, there and then. Socrates did the same, and then lead them from that. There's one story where one of the kings comes to the Buddha and says he and his wife had a discussion last night, and they decided that nothing was dearer to them than their own selves. And that's obviously not something that the Buddha could endorse. But instead of giving him a big lecture on, you know, compassion, and, you know, he said, right, and if that's where you are, remember that everybody else feels the same about themselves. And takes that from where they are. It's, again, it's a form of empathy. But it's not going to be easy, because we jump so much into an aggressive mode of attack. It's how we're educated. At least it's how I was educated at the University of Oxford. But and I've developed a very sharp and pointlessly sharp tongue as a result. It does no good. We have to find another way forward.
Deborah Tannen, The Argument Culture. You come across that?
No.
The book, Deborah Tannen, The Argument Culture, makes that point of everything is adversarial, divided.
Yes.
Our court system, our political
yes.
system, our academic system.
Absolutely.
Needs to change.
Yes.
Over here.
Perrin Jeff Taylor from Australia. I liked your earlier paraphrasing from Corinthians, by the way. In the presence of our adversarial systems, both in the courts, both civil and criminal, and translated into our parliamentary system, also with large amounts of argumentum ad hominem, how do you hope to bring in your quest for compassion?
Look, if everybody thought this is too difficult, let's give it up. Things are too weighted against. We'd never moved anywhere. Martin Luther King would never have achieved what he did. Somehow, we have to get the silent majority active. People, when I say this thing about adversarial comments, you see people all around the hall nodding, wherever they are in the world. Yep. And people often say, well, you're just preaching to the converted. This is a nice little club. That was the Americans say, you're singing to the choir. The people who are stuck in church and have to be there anyway, or just, because they've got a professional interest in it. And I don't mind doing that at all. I'm quite happy to sing to the choir, because the choir isn't singing. The choir instead is not... They hear this compassionate ethos, they know it's what they ought to do, but we've got to get active about it. And if we all got active, we could change the world. Look what, on the other side, look what 19 people did on September the 11th, 10 years ago. And change the way if we, all of us, became vocal in this, started complaining at election time, when all these politicians seem to be doing is arguing with one another, and then they wonder why the voting figures are small. They think that people just think they're having their own private rows. And we have to be critical about we're so triumphal about our democracies, for example. But what's happened in the last few weeks is that in America we saw Barack Obama absolutely paralyzed, unable to move with the financial crisis because of all this politicking. And then there was all this fuss about bringing David Cameron home from his holiday. But when he actually arrived, what on earth could he do? Powerless again. Democracy, I'm very happy to live in a democracy, don't get me wrong. But it's a state of grace, as we used to say in the Catholic Church, something you're striving for, not something that you've ever achieved. And the absurd thing is, and this is where we should go back, not necessarily to the religious, but I like to go back to Socrates, who invented in the West the rational dialogue. And nobody could win a dialogue. It always ended up with everybody realizing they knew nothing at all. And that's the moment when you become a philosopher, said Socrates, because you know you don't know anything. And we are in that state now. things are crumbling, our financial systems are crumbling, our political systems are proving feeble. We are facing environmental horror. We don't know the answers. To say we do know the answers is irrational. And I think, you know, here's a room full of intelligent, articulate, concerned, and I'm sure deeply compassionate people. Let's get active somehow. No, I have to say nothing is happening about the Charter in the UK. I'm often called a prophet who's without honour in her own country. Because people sort of say, well, it's pointless, really, you know, or they ask, how's the Charter doing? Rather, as they used to ask after one of my ageing relatives who was hanging on too long. So get active, all of us. Don't just leave it to a few people. If every one of us here worked as hard as someone like Martin Luther King or Gandhi, we could take this mess around.
What I'm going to suggest, there are a lot of hands up, so can we maybe just have a few questions going round quite quickly? Let's say six, three from this side, three from this side, and then Karen can comment on them, because there's a lot of people who want to say something. So who's next up here?
Any of the businessmen that support you, are they in the armaments industry? No. And have you ever heard of Positive News newspaper?
No.
Well, it's wonderful. Oh. It's wonderful. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Over here.
My name is Paman. Regarding applying the golden rule to our interpersonal communications, I work with a lot of people as a psychotherapist who go through a great deal of suffering because of their passivity and being mistreated. So, you know, which leads to low self-esteem and difficulties. And when we explore assertiveness, they say, well, that's being selfish. I can't speak up for myself. That's being selfish, which perpetuates the difficulties. So what's the place of assertiveness, connecting that with the golden rule?
Yes, can we just park that for a moment? Shall I give you some?
I'll come round. Yeah. Yes. I have the pen. Could you?
Yes, indeed.
Thanks.
Here we are. Hi, over here.
Judith Priest. Actually, mine follows on from that I was also very mindful of variations on the golden rule, and particularly mindful of those who have little experience of self-love and self-compassion. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that the question came into my mind is not only what love do I wish to receive, and that there are subtle differences in all of us as to our version of what love is and our perception of it, but also then what love does the other wish to receive, because it may be very different from the love that we wish to give.
Yep, that's good.
Thank you. And then over here, next.
My name's Richard. What does a charter offer to young people who are often disenfranchised and bombarded by the values of society that really you're fighting against?
Thank you. And then over here again.
Ready. Yeah, Anna Lubelska, Director of Spiritual England. We're taking action. We're promoting, we're starting a peaceful schools movement in England, but obviously in other places are doing it as well. And we'll definitely incorporate the Charter for Compassion into that. We're looking at all aspects of schools and how schools can be full of peace, and also how they can promote peace within their communities. Thank you.
Thank you. That sounds great. Next, over here. And then there's a couple of people down here who'd like to ask questions, Claudia. Yes? Who's got the microphone?
Eddie Bellimoria. Daniel Barenboim's West East Divan Orchestra is a glowing example of a supreme attempt to bring warring factions together. And look at the wonderful music and the glowing example of tremendous feeling for music. Now, my question is, how can we take this further and apply that principle, that example, even further, and not just restricted to an orchestra, wonderful though that is?
And let's take one more up here, and then we'll allow Karen to respond.
Florence Morton from Peterborough. Karen, thank you so much for that. That was really, really
Where
good.
Are you?
And up here.
Yeah, thank you.
Just to say that I heard from my niece in Vancouver about the Charter for Compassion about 18 months ago. And just to let you know that I spoke with my husband about it at length, and he's working with the other faith groups in Peterborough, where they have an annual service together of some sort, and it's usually built around food and things that they have in common. But this year, it's going to be the Charter of Compassion. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to respond
yes.
to those? And then we'll take one or two more down here.
Some terrifically important things here and here. Step three is compassion for yourself in my scheme. Unless you learn to have compassion for yourself, you can't be compassionate to other people. I mean, I know I've been in a state myself, believe it or not, when I emerged from my convent, I could not speak assertively in class. I couldn't say anything at all. And I was suicidal for years with sort of an anorexic. Out of sheer grief, I think, and feeling I was dreadful, etc. And so I do know that. And part of the trouble was I was always beating myself up for being sort of feeble or selfish and all these things. That doesn't mean you excuse everything that you do, but you have to say, frankly, that unless you're Adolf Hitler, you know, most of our faults are fairly petty, to be honest. I mean, you know, that can be a form of pride too, that I'm such a terrible person. You know, and actually, one's just a petty, self-obsessed bore a lot of the time. But you must look at this shadow side you have of yourself. We've all got a side we don't want others to see. And it may not be anything drastic, like some lurid sexual fantasy, or it may be, you know. But it may also be some little petty faults that we don't want anybody to know about ever, even our nearest and dearest, or dreams and self-pitying fantasies we have. Everybody has them. We have to live with that and say, yes, this is what I am. And learn to sort of accept yourself for what you are. That's a huge thing. And this is what a lot of your therapy work is about doing. You must give things to yourself. I mean, I, for example, just been talking, you know, with people here. I've worn myself out with the Charter, and I'm getting scratchy and tired. And again, you have to sort of give some time to yourself, too, to give it back. If you can, that's a great luxury. Because when you're in a place like Pakistan sometimes, where people are being bombed every day, or Libya or something, this is not so, you know, we don't have that luxury. We have to remember that. But we are unhappy with ourselves in the West. We're sort of so target-oriented that if we're not ticking those boxes, we're somehow some kind of failure. It's not selfish to give yourself stuff. And also your point about others' peoples will need different kinds of love. Absolutely, that's the point of the golden rule. It's not just a question of being nice. And you have to think, too, about the good of everybody concerned. And you have to say, that's why I rather like the negative version of the golden rule rather than the positive version of the golden rule, because people going around doing things for other people that they'd like themselves, your husband's having an affair with someone, well, I'd like to know, you know, that's not necessarily the right thing to do. It requires a lot of thought and intelligence and thinking things through. But remembering that we all have pain, we all have these, we're all utterly flawed creatures, all of us. And so when we castigate ourselves for our own flaws, everybody, even these upright people, have the same. Martin Luther King, deeply flawed human being, great womanizer, but look what he achieved. Even Gandhi had his flaws. We all have them. And we're ashamed of them. But no, we just take them, do your best with them, work with what you've got, not what you feel you should be, and go from there. We're all wounded too, in one way or another. And it's a question of accepting these wounds. That's part of life's dukkha, and then moving forward. But one of the best ways is actually thinking about using that pain to think of others, and so that you when you look at a terribly poignant picture on the news of pain, just think of that person, for example, someone in a flood or an earthquake or something that just has struck you, and think, I know what it's like to feel absolutely down and out and destroyed, and reach out, okay? So that can be also be a healing thing, because, again, you feel you're not alone. So there's very good quick steps, all this, all these ideas. Barenboim, I've just become a patron of the bereaved family circle in Israel-Palestine, where people who've suffered, who've had children killed in the conflict, but on both the Palestinian and the Israeli side, have come together to say, we don't want this to happen to anybody else. And on Peace Day next month, I just did a video for them a couple of days ago, it would be played, and I think Saatchi and Saatchi are going to get that film, all the things that are going on there, and get the idea out, because this is another beacon to us all. People who have experienced extreme pain, and instead of using it to fuel the conflict more and more anger, to say enough and reach out and be with one another. On Peace Day next month, they are going all to give blood. And we're hoping that this will happen also in other trouble spots like Ireland and Bosnia. It's called a movement for blood brothers. And I think it's a wonderful thing because it reminds us that we, despite our differences, whatever side we're on, we all have blood. We are all human beings. We all need blood. We all need each other's blood. We are blood brothers. Under the skin, we have this shared humanity, and that again is that source of, you know, that complete from the front line again, and I think if that again is a story that the news should be heralding, they want me to go over and speak to them because they say they haven't really got anyone on the religious side on this. To bring that to it. But so there are these wonderful initiatives. And I think of my Pakistanis too, being there on the front line, misunderstood. And they did a wonderful video which started out with a pop song. And one of the people on my council who created the charter is Salman Ahmad, who is a Pakistani pop star who is also a social activist. And it starts off, you know, nobody cares about us here in Pakistan. Nobody cares about us. And that's the impression they have. And then how we can turn that around. You know, but I agree with you, the Barenboim thing, but also the blood brothers, the bereaved families. That, again, is something that we need to get out there and make it an annual event. And again, the imagery will often speak to people more than a lot of sermons or talks like mine. Vancouver, I'm going to Vancouver for 2 weeks next month, and next year in March. I've been given an award and I'm spending 2 weeks there, and they're going to get, I'm sure I shall, Vancouver to become one of the cities for compassion. And I think great to get to know other faiths, interfaith work. One of the things I want us to do though is to develop a more global outlook. That while the situation is local, we've got to become more cognizant of what is happening in other parts of the world. Otherwise, how can we vote correctly for our governments, you know, and their policies? I mean, people were voting in the United States for war with a country they called Iraq. I did say, look, if you're going to fight a country, at least learn how to pronounce it. But to find out about the truth, to find out what your governments are doing, this is a responsibility for us. And if we use our vote, we have to sort of become informed. So while these local initiatives are good, and we have to start at home, charity begins at home, or as Confucius said, charity begins in the family. It's a school of compassion. But we can't stop in the home. We've got to remember the enemy, the other, and the enemy is now at home. Our cities are multicultural, multilingual, and that's causing problems in Europe. So we've got to develop that, again, that sense of outreach and the fact that we are a global society. Is there anything
I think we're going to need to get some coffee. Yes, thanks. No, we haven't time for any more questions, but there will be some more time at the end of the morning with Ian McGilchrist and Karen Armstrong together. I'm reminded of the slogan of Russell and Einstein during the 1950s when they were campaigning against nuclear weapons, which is "Remember your humanity and forget the rest," which I think is a very powerful statement. I want to say one other thing in connection with what Karen has shared with us this morning. And a couple of young friends of mine have started this new initiative, which I think is something resonates with what Karen has been saying this morning, called Band for Hope. Band and then the figure four, hope. And this is it. It's a zinc and copper band which you can wear. There is a website that there's anything, a proportion of any sale from these goes to charity. And the idea is actually once you buy a band, you wear it for a bit, and then you actually pass it on to somebody else, and you can then see the progress of your band around the world by having the log number, and you can follow it to see where it goes. And so it's not my daughter knows a lot more about this initiative than I do. So if she was here, she'd be able to tell you about it. But you can look it up. And I think it'll be very consonant with the Charter for Compassion that we've heard about this morning. Well, I hope you feel as inspired as I do by what Karen has shared with us this morning. Not only inspired, but also energized. Can we perhaps remind ourselves as we go out of the conference and back into our families and communities that we have, as it were, signed up to this Charter for Compassion? I certainly am doing so, and I encourage you all to do so as well. Karen, thank you very much for sharing your inspiration.